morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is the sulfuric acid antitrust litigation. Mr. LaRocca.
Thank you, Your Honor. Robert LaRocca for the plaintiff's appellants. There are three issues before the court: the per se rule, the statute of limitations, and the class certification, and I'd like to address those in that order, although I think the per se is the predominant issue on appeal. This is a clear case of a horizontal output restriction, and it's a paradigm of a per se case under the Sacconi vacuum case and the Your Honor's opinion, Judge Connie, in the Andreas case. In Sacconi, of course, the large refiners bought.
You know, what I don't understand is why is it that you have given up on the rule of reason? You say either we hold that this is a per se case or you give up. Even though you've been at this case for 9 years. Why are you so unwilling to? I mean, I understand why you prefer a per se theory, but why are you unwilling to proceed on a rule of reason basis?
Your Honor, I think it goes back to. I understand your question. The per se rule, as the Supreme Court has said, is for business certainty, but it's also for litigation certainty. Lawyers have to be able to rely on the law.
No, I understand you prefer per se. My case is, my question is, why are you giving up, right? Because all doing it under the rule of reason means is that the defendants get to make an argument that, you know, this looks like price fixing, maybe, you know, shutdown agreements. But really, they're ancillary to a lawful purpose, and they try to show that, and you would try to rebut that.
Judge, I'd like to.
Are you saying that you can't rebut it? That if they say this is is ancillary to a lawful purpose, you would say, yeah, I guess that's true. Nothing we can say about it.
Judge, I think the answer to your question is that. There are various formulations of what the rule of reason really requires. You had one in General Leaseways, which I think we could meet. There are other ones, and in Valley Liquors, for example, you said you can infer market power from market share. We did a market share study. What we didn't do here was a full-blown kind of market power that you'd need in a Section 2 monopoly case or a Section 7 merger case, where you get into cross-elasticities of supply, cross-elasticities of demand.
And if everything you've shown, that you think you've shown, would be a prima facie case under the rule of reason. The only difference between rule of reason and per se is that with rule of reason, a defendant gets to make arguments that he can't make in per se. So if you have a per se price-fixing agreement, the defendant can't come in and say, yeah, we fixed prices, raised prices, restricted output, etc. We ran a cartel, old-fashioned cartel, but it's time, you let us argue cartels are good. They provide certainty to consumers. We could reduce our advertising expenditures. Great. Now the courts won't listen to that argument, right? But on the other hand, they will listen to arguments about how something that looks anti-competitive is actually promotes competition. You know, doctrine of ancillarity and so forth. So why weren't you prepared? Put in your prima facie case, price fixing. And then let them come back and say, no, it looks that bad, maybe, but it's not really, right? And then you could rebut that. That's what I don't get. 9 years you've spent on the case, and you're willing to throw it away if we don't agree with you that it's a per se case.
Sojin, perhaps it was my short-sightedness or misunderstanding, but my understanding of what would have been required to prepare expert reports in a rule of reason case would have been essentially like a Section 7 merger case, in where you really go into or a Section 2 monopoly case.
I don't understand you. If you can show price fixing, that's prima facie illegal under the rule of reason or anything. Then they come back and say, no, it's not like that. Then you fight it out there. Don't get it.
Well, we made the election. We thought it was a per se case. We prepared our expert reports consistent with a per se case. We tailored our discovery persistent.
That wasn't very prudent, because this is an unusual case. I've never seen a case like this. It's unusual. And, you know, the general view is if you have some alleged anti-competitive behavior that doesn't fit the norm, because you have these Canadian companies, which have this, you know, they're producing this sulfuric acid. They don't want it. It's like, you know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice. They keep producing it. And they decide, you know, we've got to, it's very costly. We can't store it. We have environmental problems. We want to sell it very cheaply. The only market we have would be the United States. They produce sulfur, but on the other hand, it's much more costly for them because we're trying to get rid of it. So, but we don't have distribution in the United States. We need distribution. And it's the U.S. sulfuric acid manufacturers have the distribution. So we've got to make a deal with them, right? They'll be our distributors. We don't want them competing with us, our manufacturers. We want them to be our distribution network. Now, maybe they went too far in the way in which they went about setting up this distribution network. But it's not a conventional price-fixing case.
I respectfully disagree. I think it's like Andreas, where existing manufacturers of the same interbrand competition or potential competitors got together to restrict the supply of lysine. And here they said expressly,
manufacturers in the United States, as I understand it, they make this sulfuric, they make and sell sulfuric acid, but it's not a very profitable business. So the Canadian companies come along and say, you know, forget the manufacturing. We'll do that. It's very cheap for us. And you be our distributors. And we don't want you competing with us, right? We want you to be our distributors. We want a distribution network. So you guys get out of the manufacturing, which is peripheral for you. And you do our distribution. Now, maybe on balance, that's anti-competitive. They should have allowed the manufacturers to keep on competing. But it's an unusual case. So why don't we explore, you know, whether this really on balance is a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, we looked at it as an agreement, and there are explicit agreements. These were ongoing manufacturing plants. Naranda said, we don't want to.
You know, you take a case like BMI. BMI and ASCAP engage in explicit price fixing. They tell the composer, this is what you get for your song. And all the composers get the same thing per song. And that's price fixing. The Supreme Court said, well, it's not per se illegal because there are a lot of benefits from this. You know, you can't be a composer and deal with. You can't be an individual and deal with 1,000 different radio stations.
But as you said, in General Leastways, the heart of that case is that a new product was being brought to market that none of those 10,000 composers...
Well, this is certainly a new product in the sense that Canadian sulfuric acid is new in the United States, and it's cheaper, and prices fell. Now, your experts said, well, they didn't fall as far as they did in Florida, and this shows that there's monkey business going on. So that's fine. But why would you want that to be conclusive? I mean, I know why you'd want it to be, but why should we say that's conclusive and this is just like, it's just an ordinary cartel?
We think it is controlled by the output restriction. When you've got horizontal interbrand manufacturers agreeing with each other to take out capacity, existing capacity,
because they're
substitute.
Converting to distribution. They didn't used to distribute for other people. Now they're distributing for Naranda, Falconbridge. So they're in a different business, and they found this attractive, rather do the distribution than the manufacture.
Naranda said, we want to displace this acid so as not to... Strategies being followed so as not to force an oversupply into a balanced market with predictable price disruptions. That's at A169. I mean, that was the heart of what their objective was here, to get the highest price in the merchant market. And they had other options. They could have gone down to Florida, and they considered that, you know, we have lots of documents where they're constantly looking at the Florida market. But they say, no, we want these higher merchant industrial prices, but we don't want to disrupt the prices. So what are we going to do? We're going to take out 400,000 tons out of the existing market. That is a per se output restriction scheme.
Well, what would their price have been with unrestricted competition? Well, how far would prices fall?
Well, that's counterfactual. We don't know how far they would have fallen, but I think they would have tracked.
Counterfactual. You have an expert doing this elaborate econometric work.
Well, they would have tracked the movement of the Florida fertilizer price, which is our benchmark. There's always going to be some premium. They would never fall to the level of the Florida price because that's such a large market. It's got much bigger quantities. You've got, you know, ship to states, you've got smaller quantities and so forth. So there's always going to be a premium in the industrial merchant market. But that gap would have been less, and the movement would have tracked. That's what would have happened if Naranda had come in with its 2 million tons, so eventually 2 million tons. It started out as they wanted to displace 400,000 tons. They did that within the first 2 years, and then ultimately, through the so-called joint venture, they were able to unload up to 2 million tons that came out of the horn. That is an output restriction scheme. Its purpose was not to disrupt price. It was to enter the market, and the only way they could do that without disrupting price was to take out existing capacity.
Price did fall.
What?
Price did fall.
That is, they claim it fell during the joint venture period, not during the merchant industrial. The economists have different competing views about that. Our price series shows that the prices were stabilized compared with the...
So tell me what's wrong with stabilizing prices.
Because they said we don't want price...
No, what is wrong with stabilizing prices, right?
That's what Saccone Vacuum's
all
about.
Yes, I know, and that decision is like 70 years old, right?
Well, it's been cited...
Lots changed since Saccone Vacuum. Lots.
It's been cited repeatedly by this court.
Yes, of course, but a lot has changed. You really think the Supreme Court would write the same opinion today?
The current Supreme Court, I think it would be a 5-4 decision. Is my
different. Well, that's a completely different world.
I would like to talk for a minute about the joint venture, which Judge Kaur. So you've got the two largest entities. Naranda and Falconbridge with 2 million tons, DuPont with 1 million tons, getting together.
There's nothing more common than for two firms or multiple foreign firms to form a joint venture for an export market. What's wrong with that?
This was not an export market. This was in the...
America, right? And they're Canadian.
It was an output marketing entity.
Yeah, they're marketing in a foreign country, so they do it through a joint venture, which is extremely common.
The origins, well, as
and
judge...
I'm concerned about the idea of the judges saying, you know, what's a good joint venture, what's a bad joint venture?
Your Honor, the joint venture is really a misnomer here. They called it an LLC to escape Hart-Scott-Rodino scrutiny by the FTC and DOJ. What it really is they internally structured it so they could squeeze through this little wrinkle in the informal advice the FTC gave, that where they term themselves a partnership. So if you've got a partnership which has no assets.
I don't understand your no assets business. What does that have to do with anything?
Well, because true joint ventures,
whether they have leases or they have fee simple, what does that matter? That doesn't have anything to do with
such traditionally as
what difference would it make if you had a rule which says joint ventures have to have physical assets? What on earth would a rule like that do for anybody? What would that do for competition? They could easily restructure this to have assets in the joint venture.
But the
difference would it make?
The anti-competitive origin of this is so explicit.
What does it do with assets?
The assets
they could transfer hundreds of millions of dollars in assets to the joint venture. How would that make it less anti-competitive?
Well, what's the difference between...
Well, you answer my question. How would it be less anti-competitive if they had assets in it?
The way the law looks at it, to my understanding, is that when the purpose of a joint venture is...
Tell me what difference it makes. If we lay down a rule which says that joint ventures have to have physical assets, and all the joint ventures comply, and now they all have assets, what difference would that make for competition?
Judge, that one aspect alone is not dispositive. But when you
not dispositive. What conceivable consequence for competition would there be of a rule which said that joint ventures have to have assets?
Because that means that the joint venture is independently producing something pro-competitive. It's not simply a cartel of two parents.
It doesn't matter whether this sulfuric acid gets manufactured some plant as a byproduct, some plant in Canada. Now, suppose they say Noranda owns the plant and Falconridge owns another plant. That's one thing. The other thing they say, all right, we'll lease these assets to the joint venture, or we'll sell a 20% interest in these assets to the joint venture. What difference does it make?
Because,
right? They control the joint venture. Does it matter whether the assets are in the joint venture or they're in the parents?
It's traditionally been a test.
It may be traditional. What sense does it make?
I think the thought behind it is that if the purpose of a joint venture is to create a new product, really be pro-competitive.
That's usually the purpose of a joint venture.
Or explore a new market.
Often a joint venture is just a way of marketing a product and, you know, economizing on distribution. I mean, there's nothing more common than joint ventures. And I don't think whether they have assets, don't have assets, I don't see how that makes any difference.
Well, this joint venture engaged in the shutdown of two more plants right out of the box. Those are per se violations.
But that's the same as your original agreement. You're challenging shutdown agreements. It doesn't matter. Alleged shutdown agreements. It doesn't matter whether they're done by the joint venture or done by these companies individually. And I also understand
these companies
your concern about the territorial allocation. Again, nothing's more common than to give a distributor a territory, right? So, typical vertical restraint, not per se illegal.
Your Honor, I'm into my rebuttal time. Should I save it or?
Okay, we'll forget about the territorial restrictions. You can save the rest of your time.
I'd like to answer your question.
Okay.
Territorial restrictions in and of themselves would be clearly analyzed under Sylvania, under the rule of reason. But when it's part of a horizontal scheme...
What does it mean, part of a horizontal scheme?
It means that first they displaced First, these horizontal competitors displace the acid.
Right. You tell your distributors, you're no longer manufacturing. You want to be our distributor, no manufacturing. Okay, now you have distributors.
And so
you could say you can sell anywhere. You could say you sell in this area, you sell in that area.
We want to stifle price competition. There's too much price competition going on.
If they're going to be distributors for Noranda Falconridge, then Noranda Falconridge will set a price, right, of which these people buy, and that'll filter down to the retail area. So what do they gain by, in terms of, how are consumers adversely affected by the fact that each distributor has its own territory?
Well, they said only Marcellex can sell in this zone. They said they're beating each other up.
Distributor, you just sell here. What difference does it make to anybody?
Because
the acid is all the same.
The acid is the same, but there was competition going on among distributors, and they wanted to stop it.
You say that because of these shutdown agreements, these companies no longer making acid. They're just distributing it.
Right. But they're
what difference does it make whether they do it in one territory or multiple territories?
Well, Monsanto says that when you've got what would otherwise be a vertical restriction as part of...
What do you mean part of? Now, you could have part of if you said that the vertical restriction reinforced somehow the horizontal. You're worried about cheating or something like that. You're worried about your competitors cheating. So you place restrictions on the retailers so they can't... Okay, so, but I don't see where that's a factor here, is it? Are you saying some little manufacturer, it's agreed to go out of the manufacturing business and just be a distributor, but it wants to cheat, and somehow it'll be able to cheat better if you don't have exclusive territories? Is that the idea?
Noranda saw it as, all we know from the documents is that Noranda saw it as a way of tamping down price competition that was occurring in the U.S. market.
But you could only have price competition if these companies remained as manufacturers.
Well, unless you say that the acid that's being substituted is really part of the original shutdown scheme.
Walgreens is a factor in the manufacture of electric razors because it sells them?
Judge, the idea of the shutdown is voiced in those original 1988 documents, the same page that talks about we're going to go out and convince the U.S. manufacturers to shut down, right. Says we have to also put them in territory so there's no competition.
Well, how do they compete if they're not making acid anymore?
Because they're distributing. Noranda's whole strategy here was to prevent price competition.
Well, how do you get price competition in the acid market if these people have all ceased manufacturing? What are they competing? They can't sell acid anymore.
They can't sell as manufacturers, but they can sell as distributors who are proxies for the manufacturing that used to take place.
Look. Noranda charges a price to its distributors, right? They're the purchasers. And let's say it doesn't want price competition, so it can charge a higher price to distributors than otherwise. Now, suppose these distributors get into violent competition with each other. What that means is their margin, when they resell the acid to the acid consumers, is going to be less than if they didn't compete. Noranda will be better off because anything that compresses the margin of the distributor increases the demand for the manufactured product.
But under the revenue sharing formulas, Noranda's worse off, not better off, because Noranda's hit by your scenario too. So it suffers the impact. And it was trying, and so it has an interest in preventing that very competition.
Wait, how does it suffer?
The revenue sharing formulas say that whatever the increase or decrease is in the ultimate price the distributor gets is borne between the distributor and Noranda. That was the heart of those revenue sharing formulas. So Noranda has a vested interest in stopping the very competition that you just hypothesized.
Well, you're saying that these exclusive territories are a way of compensating. So you're saying a way of compensating them?
I'm just saying they're part of the scheme.
Well, what's the goal? Is it somehow, I don't understand, how does Naranda benefit from this?
Naranda benefits by getting the highest possible price in the merchant market for this cheap smelter acid, which is a byproduct to it, and which it would unload in Florida at about half the price.
But how does it do better because it's expanding the margin of its distributors?
Well, I understood your question to be if the distributors beat up on the customer, that Naranda would benefit from that. And I'm saying under the revenue-sharing formulas, Naranda would not benefit. It would be worse off.
It would just affect the formula. I don't understand.
No, because the formula was the allocation of the increase or decrease in the ultimate price.
The lower the margin, the better off Naranda is. And if it has to compensate the distributors for their depressed margins, well, okay, that's a trade-off. And it can do that with exclusive territories or in other means. But I don't see how that's going to affect the price of acid. Okay. Anyway, time has expired, but I'll give you rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Gustman?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is David Gussman, and I'm here speaking on behalf of all the appellees. Your Honor, this morning you have before you a case where the principal issue is whether or not the rule of reason should have applied at trial. For the reasons that we've articulated in our cases, and indeed in all the modern antitrust law in the last 40 years, the rule of reason applies to alleged horizontal cases when there are plausible pro-competitive justifications proffered. As the lower court found, there were numerous plausible pro-competitive.
Assuming that the plaintiff could prove actual shutdown agreements, evidence is not entirely clear, but suppose they could prove that, how would that be, what would be the social benefits of that?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, one of the key things that makes it unusual is that this is alleged to be a displacement case. Actually, Naranda and Falconbridge's output increased during the time period in question. So what you have is a situation where the lower cost involuntarily produced acid is coming into the market and is increasing into the marketplace. So the so-called shutdown agreements really, Your Honor, are make-buy agreements. That's how we describe them, or distributor agreements, which are very common and typically do not present an antitrust issue. These distributors made a decision to make or buy their acid. And as a result of that decision, very low-cost acid came into markets that previously had higher costs.
I understand their decision, but suppose a distributor said to Naranda, well, we'll be happy to distribute your acid, but, we make our own acid, so we'll sell some of that also. And what acceptable reason would Naranda have for saying, no, you must get out of the production?
Well, first of all, I'm not aware of any evidence to that fact that any distributors did what you're postulating or suggested. In fact, all the evidence is to the contrary. They made independent decisions. But let's assume they said, no, we want to produce as well. In fact, Naranda did sell to distributors who also produced as well. Koch, one of the alleged co-conspirators, continued to produce acid and bought from time to time, making make-buy decisions, and others as well, PBS. So there are, when you look at the realm of time, you see various different decisions being made by various different defendants as to whether to make or to buy. And I don't think the plaintiffs would say that alone presents an antitrust issue. Their case seems to be that this was some type of output reduction case. And my first point is that actually there is no evidence that output decreased in these markets.
No, I understand. But suppose Miranda said to a producer, we want you out of the market, and we'll make you a distributor, but you have to agree not to produce. Mm-hmm. Now, what excuse could be given for that, assuming the evidence showed an agreement of that sort?
Well, there are many plausible pro-competitive reasons for that type of, even if that was an agreement, let's assume that occurred. Most importantly, it gave an assurance to Noranda, who was going to continue to produce acid, that it would have a distributor that would pay attention and sell its acid. That was very important because the Noranda Falconbridge defendants are not chemical companies. They are smelters. They're not in this business.
They're what?
They're smelters and mining companies. The only chemical that they produced was the sulfuric acid, and Your Honor, I have read, as a result of environmental legislation that came on stream in the 80s to take it out of the smokestacks, of the smelting stacks. So it was important to them, and the positive benefit to the distributor is the distributor gets a steady stream of low-cost acid as well. And a very important point of this case is there's no evidence that any distributor closed down to take more expensive acid. That might have raised a red flag, but that's not the evidence before this court. The distributors made the classic make-buy decision, which people do and companies do all the time. Noranda, Falconbridge, in the late 80s, early 90s, did not have, as Your Honor mentioned earlier, a distribution network. Plaintiffs suggest otherwise. Of course, these are could be battles of fact. But one thing the plaintiff, I think, misspoke is prices did go down, and that's an undisputed fact during the time that these so-called shutdown agreements took place.
Well, their argument didn't go down as fast as it did, as they did in Florida.
Well, that is one of their arguments, but I also want to make sure the record's clear. Prices,
right.
It was paragraph 18 of Judge Kaur's extensive summary judgment analysis. Prices were going down during the make-buy shutdown slash agreements. They also dropped dramatically just after the joint venture was formed. The joint venture created tremendous competition in the marketplace and created significant efficiencies, which I can touch on as well. You asked the question, does it matter whether it has assets or not? I would submit it doesn't matter whether it has assets or not. They're joint ventures and partnerships. Law partnerships, where maybe you just combine your intellectual skills into a partnership and bring a pen and pad of paper. That doesn't mean that it's a sham, which is what plaintiffs suggest. It's just one indicia of what I would call economic integration. And that's really the question to address the sham argument. If the joint venture is an economically integrated entity, as this one surely was based on the uncontested facts, then you go past that and decide whether under the rule of reason there are plausible pro-competitive justifications. And the undisputed record is that the parties anticipated reductions in expense when they started. They hired, among others, Deloitte and Touche to talk about the savings that would occur by going direct as opposed to using the distributors that had been used by Noranda. And there's, as the lower court found, a substantial amount of evidence that shows that they not only anticipated efficiencies, but they achieved them. And the question of whether those are plausible pro-competitive justifications for the creation or operation of the joint venture is one that could have gone to trial, but the plaintiffs chose, as Your Honor pointed out, repeatedly from the beginning of the case till the end to proceed on per se or not at all. That's their choice. You asked counsel why. I don't know why, but he gave you his answer.
They made this clear at the beginning of the case? They said this at the beginning of the case?
They said at the beginning of the case. Their complaint is a per se case.
Yeah.
And when Judge Holderman asked him about it. They had, Mr. LaRocca admitted on, I think it was December 12th, that from the beginning of the case they proceeded on a per se case through the end.
So why can't they get to a jury on that claim? That's what Judge Kaur said.
Judge Kaur said you can.
In fact, as to that theory, that they can get to a jury on.
Our point is that all of the evidence, the pro-competitive justifications that we're proffering, should have gone to the jury, as well as their whatever arguments they want to make about the conduct, that it somehow could be per se. But what they would have this court do, or would have had the trial court do, is tie our hand and prevent us from putting on the plausible pro-competitive evidence that we had, the volumes of it, because in a per se case, a pure per se case, much of that is arguably not relevant. It's excluded. So I think there was, I think at the trial court level, Judge Kaur understood that there was a lot of pro-competitive justifications and evidence, said it repeatedly, and should have found, therefore, as Judge Holderman, that this is a rule of reason case and that's how it should go to trial. Plaintiffs have repeatedly said, we don't want to go to trial unless we can go on per se, which is unfair to defendants who have offered plausible pro-competitive justifications. A couple other points that I want to address on their arguments. There was no evasion of the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act, as we point out in our brief. There is no evidence that that was done, and agreements, the Noranda-DuPont joint venture was so widely reported, it was in the Wall Street Journal, and there's...
Are there some specified sanctions somewhere for evading Hart-Scott-Rodino?
Only if the FTC or the Department of Justice were to come in and try to, after the fact, break it up or block it because
they could have, and they have not,
and there's no evidence in the record and that they did. There was no evasion. It was done straightforward, upright, publicly disclosed.
One of your arguments is that if price had fallen too far in the United States, Noranda would be subject to anti-dumping proceedings. Was there ever any chance, though, that the price in the United States could be lower than the price in Canada? Because since there's more transportation expense if they sell in the United States.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that I'm not enough of an anti-dumping law expert to say that that's the only question. What I do know about the law is you can also compare their cost of production as another indicia of whether or not you're dumping in the United States. So if you're selling below your cost of production in the United States, you could be charged with dumping. The evidence is that the that was a motivation of Noranda's to not have a trade action initiated against it by existing manufacturers in the United States, which of course is the exact opposite of competition. So our argument is it doesn't absolve someone from an antitrust violation, but it shows what you're trying to do is you're trying to bring into the United States your lower cost asset into the marketplace, and you're trying to do so and keep it coming into the marketplace, which makes this case a very unusual case.
Have Canadian companies ever sued for dumping in the United States?
I'm sorry?
Are Canadian companies ever sued for dumping
in the United States? Yes. In fact, this company was sued in 19, it's a trade action brought in the United States, but Noranda was sued in connection with potash, another product that they produced. It's a reported decision. And so it was, in fact, it was 1987, as this was going on, that was happening in the same company. So they were very concerned about the political aspects of a dumping action and wanted to, and one of the reasons they wanted to partner with these distributors, it was to do the best they could to bring the low-cost product in without having someone go to Washington and suggest that they're selling at too low of a price. So that I think it will answer your question on dumping. On the zone agreements, I'll just touch on those briefly. The lower court found that it was uncontroverted that the purpose of them, the zone, so-called zone agreements, was to foster interbrand competition by trying to reduce intra-brand competition. There were lots of people selling product in the marketplace. These agreements were the ones in 1996 to 1998. They're vertical agreements, and the court found that would be judged by rule of reason, and Judge Kaur, as a result, found that those, because they had eschewed the rule of reason, each entered judgment in favor of the defendants on the, at the summary judgment stage. So throughout, they have, in fact, eschewed this rule for whatever purposes that they have. I'd like to touch briefly on the other aspects of the joint venture, if I might, to point out that typically joint ventures are judged under the rule of reason. The case law that supports that is, among others, American Needle, Texaco, and Polk Brothers. That's the correct standard for this type of an arrangement.
I think there's an exception to that. If the plaintiff contends and there's some evidence to support that the joint venture is essentially a sham, which is what the plaintiffs argue here, that it's simply a vehicle for continuing the shutdown agreements that had preexisted.
Your Honor, I think that is what they argue and allege, but as I think the record shows, there's substantial evidence to show that it wasn't just a sham, that there were numerous pro-competitive justifications for that arrangement. And so it should, our position is it should be judged on the under the rule of reason. It's no less or more of a sham than, say,
the Polk
Brothers.
What would be the strongest argument for it?
That
it's pro-competitive.
Oh, for the joint venture?
Yeah.
That it reduced cost and dramatically dropped price. The strongest argument would be that the costs of distribution
was
were reduced.
By using DuPont's distribution network?
Well, it was in part that as well, as to the DuPont distribution network, the DuPont, of course, is a chemical company, and they were able to utilize the sales force of DuPont to sell the acid to create what is referred to as one-stop shopping for customers. So the Miranda acid that had been previously sold only by people who sold acid.
They already had that externality, it seems to me, because it's a big chemical company.
DuPont did, but its new partners had not. Miranda and Falconbridge did not have that capability. So now their acid was brought into the joint venture, and it was able to be sold with the other products of DuPont. And that was it. That was considered an important reason for creating this joint venture based on the evidence. So that's how that aspect occurs. Expert found, he found after doing numerous economic studies on the joint venture that it was unambiguously pro-competitive, positive.
Does the joint venture still exist?
The joint venture ended in 2001, Your Honor, when DuPont withdrew from the joint venture.
Oh, and then, but Miranda, they're under joint ownership.
Now Miranda and Falconbridge.
So it's moot, the joint venture.
It's now, there's now a venture that sells a product called Norfalco, which is another defendant in this case.
But aren't they basically, doesn't Falconbridge own most of Miranda or vice versa?
They merged in 2005, and now they're actually known as Xstrata Canada.
Oh, they're Xstrata, right. Do they still sell sulfuric acid in the United States?
They do. Norfalco does.
So it's the same, I see.
They're selling it through what was the joint venture called Noranda
DuPont. So the market hasn't changed much in the sense of they still distribute through American manufacturers? And so
well, they sell some acid. They now, after the passage of time, Noranda DuPont sells some acid to other distributors and other manufacturers, and it sells acid directly as well, just as the Noranda DuPont joint venture did starting in 1998 and going through.
So the joint venture sold to acid consumers and not just to distributors? Is that?
The joint venture, yes, starting in 1988, it sold a lot of acid to I'm not sure you call them consumers.
No, not
most people don't,
unless they want to
pick up a bucket of acid or at the store, but they sold it to smaller people by truck, for example, as opposed to, you know, prior to the joint venture where they sold it to large distributors and occasionally large end users. It could take it even by vessel on the East Coast. There were a few such transactions. If there are no more questions, I have a few more minutes. It looks like I have a couple more anyway. I do want to touch on the statute of limitations briefly. I think it's an important issue, and it's an additional reason to affirm the court below. The court below applied the discovery rule to the conduct rather than the injury accrual rule that the Supreme Court and Zenith and Claire and Rotella have found is the correct rule to apply.
I don't think the courts have ever really held that. I think sometimes what they're talking about is injury, that you need injury, but that doesn't exclude discovery. I don't think the courts have ever. After a lot of cases say discovery is the federal rule on statute of limitations, and why would one make an exception for price fixing?
Because under the Clayton Act and its legislative history that we point out, and the courts have found antitrust is an exception to the general federal rule. In antitrust, the accrual rule applies and not the discovery rule. Courts have found.
What sense would that make?
One of the arguments is that because you're enabling treble damages, and this comes up in the context of RICO as well, because you're encouraging people to bring to in effect be private attorney generals, that you want them to do it promptly. When you look at the legislative debate, you will see that the legislature, when they passed the four-year statute of limitations, did not put in the discovery rule. So there are, and several of the cases we cite talk about that, the public policy of it. Our point is that we think Copper is, and the parties in Copper only argued the discovery rule. They didn't argue the injury or accrual rule.
Right, but the point is, why is the interest in repose so much stronger in this context? I mean, you want it read as a statute of repose rather than a statute of limitations, to which ordinarily a discovery rule would attach.
Well, yeah, I think the injury accrual rule is a little bit different than the statute of repose because there are some estoppel exceptions for the statute of limitation injury rule. But from a public policy standpoint, because you're going to offer people treble damages, because you want them to pursue these actions, you want them to pursue them promptly. And so, as one of the courts said, the discovery rule is the antithesis of the injury accrual rule, and points out that in antitrust you have the injury accrual rule, but in other areas of federal law you have the discovery rule. So it is a public policy issue, and we would submit that in Copper, one of the panels, because it wasn't argued, and from what we can see, and it was just accepted, the discovery rule, that the Seventh Circuit is different than many of the other circuits in terms of suggesting that the discovery rule should apply. And so for that reason, if the injury rule, accrual rule, is applied here, based on the evidence, we do not believe they have evidence of estoppel, any fraudulent concealment or other recognized forms, and therefore that would be an additional reason to affirm.
Before you sit down, if I could ask a procedural question
of course, Your Honor.
About how the issue was brought before Judge Holderman after he took over the case.
Yes.
It seems somewhat unorthodox, to say the least. It was a motion under Rule 16.
It was, Your Honor.
To clarify the issues when what it really looks like is a request that Judge Holderman revisit Judge Kaur's summary judgment ruling.
We took our cue from Judge Shader, who used that procedure in another antitrust case recently, or it was used in his courtroom, where and asked the judge, because we were getting close to trial, to decide what legal standard was going to apply. And so we were asking for a ruling under Rule 16, which we think did narrow the
issues.
Right,
but the motion was noticed up and heard all at the same time.
Well,
seems like a little bit of sandbagging.
I don't think so, Your Honor, for a variety of reasons. One, it was presented a week before. It was presented on November 22nd, not when it was actually noticed up, because they had made a motion, the defendants.
Right,
that
they wanted the zone agreements argument revisited.
They wanted Judge Holderman to reconsider the summary judgment ruling that rule of reason applied to the zone agreements. We asked in response to that we opposed it, and in response said not only should it apply to the zone agreements, but somebody needs to make that decision before we go to trial, because we need a ruling whether it's per se or rule of reason. If it's per se, then arguably we can't put on the pro-competitive justifications that and evidence, including expert testimony. So we were in a situation 2 months before trial not knowing what the standard was.
Well, there was nothing in Judge Kaur's summary judgment ruling that prohibited you from putting in proofs on both methods.
Our read was that's right. But their read was and is to this day, as I understand it, they want to try this on per se because they don't want us to put that evidence on. That's the clarification we sought.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Gussman and Mr. LaRocca, some further from you.
Just a couple of points. These pro-competitive justifications that we hear about are not what the contemporaneous documents talked about. Let's talk about the joint venture. In the year before, when they're deciding whether to form a joint venture, these two companies, the largest marketers, DuPont and Naranda Falconbridge, say, DuPont says, Naranda's been inquiring on more ways to get us to not burn sulfur. And then they say, if we don't set up this joint venture, there's going to be a, quote, ruinous internecine battle for market share. That's at 362 of the appendix. Naranda says, we do not want to enter a price war with DuPont. Lose, lose. That's at 260. Those are not
suggesting, are you, that's an improper concern for a company? I mean, obviously you don't want to be in a price war and lose your money.
Your Honor, I'm saying that it shows the true motive as, you know, Judge...
Well, suppose it's a motive. Would that poison it? I mean, obviously, companies don't like competition unless they're certain that they're going to win the competitive battle. And the question is all that's involved here price fixing, or are there, you know, legitimate concerns?
Well, and another purpose, for example, is manage our parents' inventories. You asked me about why it doesn't have assets. All of the assets were kept out, these separate manufacturing plants,
You've never suggested why keeping the assets out, putting them in, makes any difference to anything.
Because, Judge, In a competitive marketplace, DuPont could not direct Noranda as to what level of inventories of sulfuric acid there were coming into the market, and Noranda couldn't direct DuPont. Those are independent companies.
Yeah, but if you have a joint venture, and one of the things you want to do in the joint venture is coordinate inventories so you don't have overproduction, then what is it then? Okay, that's either good or bad, but it doesn't matter whether the inventories are owned by the joint venture or owned by their parents, because the parents are going to call the tune wherever the inventories are located.
Makes it under the DOJ guidelines, the FTC guidelines, it says there's no integration.
The DOJ guidelines are not the law. The question is what difference economically does it make?
Well, Judge,
do you have an expert who said...
Because what's the difference then of having Ford and GM talk to each other and say, hey, why don't you stop your production of Oldsmobiles and we'll stop our productions of Chevys for this month? You couldn't do that, to my understanding of the antitrust law. So how can they say, okay, we're going to form a joint venture, and now we can tell each other how much to produce? What? That's just form over substance.
For General Motors, you would want to. I mean, look, if in 2009, you know, agreements like that, when not Ford, Ford wasn't broke, but General Motors and Chrysler were broke, there might have been reasons for agreements like that, right? The question is whether it's so obviously anti-competitive that you don't allow the defendants to offer a justification.
Well, what is their pro-competitive justification for all these shutdowns? And by the way, Mr. Gussman refers to them as make versus buy. But when you read the record, these are negotiations that went on for 3 or 4 years. They started with, while the plants were functioning, the Searsport main plant was fully operational, and the executive involved in the negotiations put it in an affidavit saying, during the course of these discussions with Noranda, which I believe occurred over several years, Noranda's primary goal became persuading Delta to shut down its sulfuric acid plant. That's at 452. DuPont, the negotiations started in 1988 when the New Jersey plant's fully operational, and they say successful negotiations for replacing sulfur burner acid.
Is there anything wrong if you went to a competitor and said, you know, you're really hurting us with your low prices, and actually I've done an analysis of your costs and so on, and you don't realize it, but you're actually losing money at the price you're selling. Is that illegal?
I think, Your Honor, that is illegal.
Is that illegal? I want you to answer my question.
If you just go to a competitor...
I gave you the example. I want you to answer my question.
I think if there's an implicit...
No, you're saying if, and I'm asking for a yes or no answer.
If you just go to a competitor...
I don't want your ifs. I gave you the example. I want you to say yes or no.
I want to make sure I understand what you said. You go to a competitor and you say you're losing money at those prices.
Right.
And that's all you say to them?
Yeah.
Discussing prices is not among horizontal competitors is frowned upon. Would that be enough for per se violation?
No.
I don't think so. There's no agreement in what you've said.
Okay, well, we'll have to stop. So thank you very much, Mr. Rocha and Mr. Eastman. We'll move on to our next case.